Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. This episode is dedicated to America's worst president, Warren G. Harding. Here's the common view of him. Harding was a nice guy. He was outgoing, but he was dim-witted. He's from Marion, Ohio. He spends two completely undistinguished terms as a state senator, and then one as a lieutenant governor. Then he goes to the U.S. Senate in 1914, and he doesn't do much except get along with people and play poker games, smoke, drink, womanize. Then he comes out of the deadlocked 1920 Republican National Convention, headed for the presidency. He's chosen only after multiple rounds of bickering and smoke-filled back rooms because everyone thinks that nobody chooses him as his first choice, but he is the incarnation of lowest common denominator. Nobody wants him, but everyone can agree on him. His friend, the political fixer, Harry Daugherty, helped him get there. And in return, Harding put him and his pals, which were called later the Ohio Gang, in a position where they can plunder the government, while Harding has no idea what's going on, and he talks about a return to normalcy after the Wilson administration and the League of Nations and internationalism, and Harding is pushing for a more modest view of government from the United States and their role in the world. But really, even though he talks about normalcy, he's just spending time writing letters to his mistresses. Eventually, political scandals break out, but Harding dies at the end of a tour of the West, and he dies conveniently in order to escape the worst of it. This is the popular view of Harding, but a lot of historians agree. In almost every single poll of Harding, starting from 1948, where historians were polled about which president was the best and the worst, C-SPAN has regularly released these polls. And the 29th president, Warren G. Harding, has come out at the very bottom consistently. Now, what's interesting is Americans at the time didn't perceive him at this way. They were shocked by his death. There was an outpouring of national grief and reverence due to his gentility and warmth. Some people at the time even considered him Lincoln's equal because of his statesman-esque qualities. What's interesting is that some historians, not a lot, but some think that this impression of Harding at the time isn't entirely undeserved. Because he was someone who was sensitive to problems facing women and minorities and workers, this is at a time when all of them were very marginalized from society. Women only recently got the vote in 1920. Minorities were locked out of government and social services in all sorts of way. Workers' rights were nascent to non-existent. And Harding was a man who embraced these groups, but also the technology and culture of the time. So I'm talking about Warren G. Harding due to a listener question, Eric Gold. And he says, I believe Harding's attorney general, Daugherty, killed him. He had the opportunity, means, and motive. In my readings, it seems many important people of the time, including Herbert Hoover, who was part of Harding's cabinet, thought so as well. If so, why did he get away with it? Okay, so we're going to get into theories about Warren G. Harding's death. There's a lot of theories about people who may have murdered him if it wasn't just due to natural causes. So in this episode, we're going to look at the legacy of America's most hated president and if he deserves that distinction or not. And there's historians who argue both ways. The majority say he does do it, but there's a vocal minority who say that he doesn't. Then we're going to look about the theories about his death. And there are many about them and who could have murdered him if he was in fact murdered. Most of them have to do with the belief that he was always involved in scandals and womanizing, and either people wanted to kill him because these scandals could get out and he needed to be eliminated, or it was due to his jealous wife or jealous mistresses. Next, we're going to look at some lurid poetry that he sent to his mistresses, some of which was unsealed in 2014. Love letters to one of his mistresses was discovered in 1964, but his family intervened to have it sealed for 50 years. They were revealed, and this is probably the thing that Harding's going to be remembered for. You can look for a clip on John Oliver's show Last Week Tonight. It's really funny where he talks about them. Pretty raunchy, not safe for work, so you're warned, listener. We're also going to look at theories that he may have been, this is really interesting, America's first black president. I watched a three-hour-long episode on C-SPAN that delved into the life of Warren G. Harding, and two historians were talking about his legacy, and there was a call-in segment. And perhaps two to three callers asked whether Warren G. Harding, in fact, had black ancestry in his family line. So we're going to look into that theory and see if it's true or not. And finally, we'll look to see whether or not Warren G. Harding's reputation deserves to be rehabilitated. Is the world wrong, and are a few renegade historians right, that he wasn't as bad as people really think? All right, well, let's start off with why there was a positive impression of Warren G. Harding when he was president at the time of his death. Well, Harding was affable and easygoing, and he was the opposite of Woodrow Wilson. Woodrow Wilson led the United States during World War I, during the peace negotiations, the Treaty of Versailles. And Wilson was interested in America joining the League of Nations. Wilson was seen as aloof. He was an academic. He was a professor at Princeton. Many people considered him cold, distant. He didn't really like the American people. He didn't like to engage with them. He wasn't personable. And Harding was the complete opposite. In some ways, Harding was elected as a pushback against Wilson and the unpopularity in the United States with the League of Nations. 1920 was the first election in which women voted, and Harding courted the women's vote, which helped him win. Unlike Wilson, Harding had a great relationship with the U.S. Senate. Makes sense that he was a senator, too. He also had a great relationship with the press. Harding was a former newspaper man in Ohio, so he knew how the press worked. He also knew how to make them comfortable. He actually had a house in Marion, Ohio, built next to his house for press members, so they could write stories, relax after a press conference, file stories, make phone calls to their newspaper or to their wire service. And his professional experience made him knowledgeable on how to relate to them. Other things that Harding did that was popular in his administration were cutting taxes, balancing the budget. He created a budget in the government. Before him, there wasn't a budget. He started a national highway construction project. It didn't get too far, and it was only completed in the Eisenhower administration, but he got it going. He talked to titans of industry to get them to agree to an 8-hour workday for workers. He improved foreign relations with Latin America and Mexico. He appointed a strong cabinet. He appointed William Howard Taft as Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. But all of these things don't amount to a lot compared to other presidents because he wasn't in office very long. He was in office 5 months less than JFK. Now, despite doing all these things, he had a lot of vices. He enjoyed golf, poker, womanizing. He possibly fathered a child while in office. He died of a heart attack in 1923 at the age of 57. And like I said, he left behind a treasure trove of letters he wrote to his mistress that were revealed to the public in 2014, and they were raunchy. The scandals of Harding only came out after his death, and he was mourned deeply at the time during his 27 months as president. And it was only in the 1920s did his reputation collapse completely, especially when you get into the Roosevelt administration, when the previous presidents are seen as being complicit for the collapse of the economy and not putting in safeguards that allowed the stock market crash of 1929 to happen. So going back a little bit, let's look into Warren G. Harding's life. Harding grew up in a bucolic village in Ohio, Marion, Ohio, or nearby Marion, and his parents were farmers. His father did some medical study, and he called himself a doctor, although this wasn't a regulated profession at the time. It didn't take much to become a doctor, and America had barely transitioned from medical sciences as being a quack profession into a serious profession. Interestingly enough, many of Harding's family members continued the medical profession, and his uncles and cousins and others became doctors. Harding got into a newspaper work early. He became a Republican, and he served three political offices before president: the Ohio State Senate, then a lieutenant governor, then part of a group of U.S. senators elected in 1914, and then after serving a term, he became president. Now, two words that I haven't mentioned yet that will forever be linked to Harding's administration, and if you learned about Harding in school, what you learned about him is this: Teapot Dome, or the Teapot Dome Scandal. This is the name of the Wyoming Naval Oil Reserve that Secretary of the Interior Albert Fall leased secretly to oil tycoons. They were leased to Edward Doheny and Harry Sinclair in return for more than $400,000 in bribes, and this is millions and millions of dollars today. Harding had approved Fall's request that the oil reserve be transferred from the Navy to the Department of the Interior. So he was considered implicated in the scandal, even though the transfer wasn't judged an illegal act until a few years after the fact. When Harding learned of this influence peddling and bootlegging and other acts of Jess Smith, the companion and closest friend of his attorney general, Harry Daugherty, he immediately removed Smith from his inner circle. The most damaging scandal, although this was a less colorful one than the Teapot Dome scandal, involved the profiteering of Charlie Forbes, and this was exorbitant profiteering, who was head of the Veterans Bureau, a department that Harding had created. Forbes enjoyed the confidence of Harding, and he was able to dupe the president for months after reports that he was getting kickbacks from resold medical supplies and hospital building site contracts. Harding knew what Forbes was doing long before demanding his resignation, so Harding could have been technically tried for criminal conspiracy, which is a felony. But no evidence turned up that Harding was more deeply involved in the scandals that darkened his administration or that he personally profited from them. So there's not evidence that he was directly involved in them. The evidence directly implicates members of his cabinet, but even though many historians know this, they still think that he was a dupe or not able to control the people around him. And whether or not he was personally involved, his administration, which he was ultimately responsible for, was a terrible period of corruption. Let me get back into some of the bright spots of his administration. And this comes from an article by Carl Anthony called The Most Scandalous President. He created the Bureau of the Budget, headed by Charles Dawes, which first gave the federal government an operational budget. And most interestingly of all, of his presidency, which happened in the early 1920s, after the administration of Woodrow Wilson, who had Klan members at a State of the Union address, who showed a birth of a nation at the White House, was Harding's total lack of racial prejudice in a highly intolerant era. Well, at least total lack of racial prejudice that we can consider for the time. And most interesting is his progressive attempt to change mainstream white America's attitude toward racial minorities. Harding appointed Albert Lasker as head of the shipping board. He was the first ever high-profile presidential appointment who was Jewish. Lasker was one of Harding's closest friends. He accompanied him to Florida golfing vacations and was always involved in White House poker games. In the Warren Harding papers, there's a letter from Alfred Cohen, a lifelong friend whom Harding first met in the Ohio legislature. Cohen wrote a letter to a would-be Harding biographer that Harding was devoid of racial or religious prejudices. And this guided his appointments of Rabbi Joseph Kornfeld as minister to Persia and Father Joseph Denning as an agent and consul general at Tangier. One of the most interesting events of Harding's presidency was his speech on October 26, 1921, to a segregated crowd in Birmingham, Alabama. He said that democracy would always be a sham until African Americans received full equality in education, employment, and political life. The first president to discuss civil rights in the South so frankly, and he was cheered by blacks, and the whites in the audience stared at him in silence. He said, "I want to see the time come when black men will regard themselves as full participants in the benefits and duties of American citizenship. We cannot go on as we have gone on for more than half a century with one great section of our population set off from their real contribution to solving national issues because of a division of race lines. Let the black man vote when he is fit to vote, prohibit the white man from voting when he is unfit to vote. So it's interesting, a lot of histories written in the 1960s and 19th centuries from African-American authors speak very positively of Harding. And this gets into theories that he may have been ancestrally part black. So among some sections of the American population, he was much more popular than mainstream opinion would suggest. Part of the reason Harding did this, it wasn't due to munificence. I mean, politicians always have to consider re-election and their party's interests at times. So of course, there's a political angle here. And he wanted to increase the Republican Party's base in the South by allowing blacks who had been traditionally Republican to vote. And they had been barred in many ways in the South due to Jim Crow laws and other things. Harding also promoted his view that on both sides, there shall be recognition of the absolute divergence in things social and racist. But in Birmingham, Harding went further than any other president since Lincoln to call for an end to prejudice. Alabama's Senator Tom Heflin responded quickly. He didn't like this, nor did many Southerners, who heavily criticized Harding for threatening what he called God's plan for racial separation. But at the same time, there were dozens of editorials in Northern newspapers that praised his speech. After his inauguration, with the support of the NAACP, Harding proposed an anti-lynching bill and an interracial commission to recommend ways to improve race relations. Southern white Republicans, who were trying to purge their party of black influence so they could get control of the South from Democrats, were opposed to this. However, Harding listened to his party and didn't make good on his promise to appoint African Americans to any high federal positions. At the same time, a Democratic filibuster killed the anti-lynching bill in the Senate, and the House finished off his interracial commission. Harding welcomed women into politics, and no president until FDR did so strongly. In 1921, Harding defied opposition from medical interests and states' rights proponents and conservative members of Congress to sign the Sheppard-Towner Act, which provided funding and federal oversight for state programs on infant mortality and health care for women and children. Harding also supported workers' rights. He supported the right for workers to bargain collectively, and he spoke against strikes only when public safety was at risk, as when railroad workers and coal miners went out in 1922. Early in his administration, he tried to abolish the 12-hour workday and the 6-day work week, putting pressure on the steel industry, and he met with captains of industry to try to hammer out the steel. Hours before Harding's death, the big steel producers did eliminate the 12-hour workday, and they credited Harding with having spurred them to action. Harding was interested in the automotive industry, he was interested in technology, and he was also interested in the film industry. Harding was behind the first use of movie stars in a presidential campaign. The first invitations of movie stars and executives to the White House, and the first showing of films there. Harding began a White House movie library. As he explained to one theater manager in a previously unpublished letter, the screen will most securely establish itself as an accepted and useful factor in national life in proportion as it shall recognize in duty in behalf of the widest concerns of the community. It possesses potentialities of vast service, civic, educational, moral. To present on the screen, the industrial, commercial, and intellectual activities of the country cannot but widen the vision of the great audience that you daily serve. So he was very optimistic at the possibilities of film, much like people when the television was becoming common in American households were optimistic that it would make education widely available to all people. Don't know they would think about the Fast and Furious franchise if they saw what film became today. And I speak of that, and I say that as a fan of the Fast and Furious franchise. So hard to tell what Harding would think. Now, Carl Anthony notes that this doesn't negate all the scandals in Harding's administration, and I'm only giving so much weight to the positive parts of Harding's legacy because the negative parts are much, much, much more well represented in other sources. But the place that Anthony notes Harding fully lives up or down to his tarnished reputation has to do with his private life. Harding's death was immediately followed by rumors that his wife had poisoned him because of his adulteries. He'd long carried on an affair with Nan Britton, and some people questioned this for a long time, but now we have DNA evidence that he fathered a child with Nan Britton, who was 31 years younger than him, and she wrote a book in 1927 called The President's Daughter. She was the mother of his child. One of Harding's aides, Walter Ferguson, Remember the time he escorted Nan Britton to the White House and stood guard in front of Harding's office and deflected Harding's wife, Florence, from trying to enter? He said, "She stood and glared at me like she couldn't believe it. Finally, she spun around and returned to the White House. As soon as I thought it was safe, I went to the car and took the girl to a hotel." Carrie Phillips, another one of Harding's mistresses, was by all accounts the love of Harding's life for 15 years and was Florence's former best friend. Well, at one point, she blackmailed him. During the 1920 campaign, Republican supporters collected $20,000 to pay her off and send her out of the country until after the election. When news of this came out in a privately printed book, the administration sent Bureau of Investigation agents to seize the plates and printing press and destroy copies. This is the only known case of government suppression of a book in peacetime. A friend of Daugherty, Harding's attorney general, Jesse Smith, kept a secret bank account that apparently served as a blackmail fund to buy the silence of any other Harding's mistresses. Daugherty was forced to drop a Justice Department case against the former attorney general, Mitchell Palmer, because apparently he knew of one such payoff and might speak out. Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of the Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play the Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This episode is brought to you by Calitrin. Text the word UNPLUG to 30605, and I'll send you a link to a wonderful product that can help you finally succeed in shedding that extra weight. I took Calitrin for several weeks last year, and I felt great in several ways. I felt stronger, my workouts felt easier, I slept better, I was noticeably trimmer, there was no downside. Text the word UNPLUG to 30605 right now to see this week's special offer on Calitrin. Calitrin contains collagen, the most abundant protein naturally occurring in the human body, which decreases as we age. Taking Calitrin promotes better sleep, more energy, less joint pain, and best of all, weight loss. Calitrin has an 86% success rate with their 90-day supply, and this week, take advantage of my special offer. Buy the 90-day supply and get an extra month free, plus free shipping. Ordering is easy. Just text the word UNPLUG to 30605, and I'll send you a link to the special offer. Again, text UNPLUGGED to 30605.
So, you can't argue about this aspect of Harding's legacy, but some would argue, and Carl Anthony argues this, that when you look at Harding's legacy, he seems at least as competent as the middle tier to lower middle tier presidents like Millard Fillmore or Andrew Johnson, or Ulysses S. Grant, Franklin Pierce, James Buchanan, John Tyler, Martin Van Buren, and William and Benjamin Harrison, all of whom historians rank above him. So this is by no means to say that Harding belongs in the highest tier of American presidents or he should be on Mount Rushmore. Nobody is arguing that. But it's more that he doesn't belong, he doesn't deserve the distinction of always being the absolute worst president, but he's middle tier to lower middle tier. On his Fatal Western tour, during which he was hailed by the public and national press with universal praise, Harding said that he had one ambition. "I cannot hope to be one of the great presidents," he said, "but perhaps I may be remembered as one of the best loved." And you can say that he was in the 1920s. So in the end, his popularity was ephemeral. And once these scandals came to light, and by the late 1920s, when books came out claiming that he had all of these affairs and the more tawdry elements of his life were made known, then his reputation collapsed among the public and historians as well. But many think that he doesn't deserve to be rated as America's worst president, even if he was arguably America's most scandalous president. Okay, well, let's do that now. Let's get into Harding's scandals. More specifically, let's look more closely at letters he wrote to his mistress, which were only unsealed in 2014, after they were discovered in 1964, and the Harding family had them locked out for 50 years. Listeners, if you don't want to hear saucy poetry written from one president to a mistress, skip ahead for 5 or 10 minutes. For those of you who are completionists who want to know all the dirty tales of a president, here they are. And these letters and correspondences have to do with Nan Britton and Carrie Fulton Phillips, although Harding likely had many other dalliances. So who was Nan Britton? As a young Ohio teenager, she became infatuated with the state's married Republican candidate for Senate, Warren G. Harding. She passed his house one day and told Harding, who was nearly in his 50s at the time, that she decorated her room with his campaign posters. And then she said to the president, with her wife looking on in silence, that she would like to have a real photograph to go with the poster collection. During the campaign, Harding would take Britton into his office and sit her on his lap. This is before he took her virginity in a hotel room, according to her account and other accounts, and later brought her to the White House for regular rendezvous. "The fact that I was so ignorant seemed to add to his cherishment of me for some reason," she wrote in her 1927 book. And in 2015, the New York Times reported that genetic testing by Ancestry DNA confirmed that Harding was the biological father of Britton's daughter. So you know for a fact they did have relations. And if you delve into the many letters that he wrote to her, it gets raunchy, where he refers to his member as Jerry. In 2014, the Library of Congress released a batch of letters Harding wrote to his longtime mistress. The correspondence shows that the Republican National Committee paid the woman $5,000 a month to stay silent about their affair while he was president. The letters contain lines like, "I love your poise of perfect thighs when they hold me in paradise. I love the rose your garden grows, love seashell pink that over it glows." And then there's a lot more. When he mentions Jerry, he says, "Jerry came and will not go, says he loves you, that you are the only love worthwhile in all this world, and I must tell you so, and a score of more of other fond things he suggests, but I spare you. You must not be annoyed. He is so utterly devoted that he only exists to give you all." So, strong emotion right there, listeners. Well, the person who profited most from Harding's philandering was Carrie Phillips, the love of his life for 15 years, who hung the thread of exposure over Harding's head to great profit, and she received from the Republican National Convention somewhere between $20,000 and $25,000, which is nearly $300,000 today, in addition to her monthly hush money. Nan Britton was more innocent. She wrote in her book in 1927, which came out a few years after Harding's death, and this book was the first tell-all of presidential sex. She described losing her virginity to the then-Senator Harding when she was 20 and he was over 50 in a New York hotel. And she wrote, "I remember so well I wore a pink linen dress, which was rather short and enhanced the little girl look." Britton wrote Harding liked that sort of thing, and he registered in the hotel under a false name, and he and Britton then rode in silence in the elevator to a room. According to Britton's book, the New York police, Vice Squad, burst down the door soon after the lovemaking concluded, knowing the affair was illicit. The cops began to arrest the couple, despite Harding's entreaty to let the poor little girl go, but when they realized they stumbled upon Warren Harding, the senator, they apologized. Britton said, "Upon seeing that name, they became calm immediately. Not only calm, but strangely respectful. Withdrawing very soon. We completed our dressing." The relationship between Harding and Britton lasted 6 years and it went into Harding's presidency. Britton described the classy locations Harding secured for their encounters, from Harding's Senate office couch, where Britton said the baby was conceived, to one spot in the White House, a closet in the anteroom, evidently a place for hats and coats. She said that they had repaired there many times in the course of her visits to the White House, in the darkness of a space no more than 5 feet square. A Secret Service agent would apparently knock on the door to let them know when Harding's wife Florence was approaching. Once Harding died, Nan Britton found herself without financial support for her baby, so she decided to write a book about her affair with the president. No one really believed her stories at first, or that the child was Harding's, and Britton was denounced as a liar or gold digger. One congressman introduced a bill in the House to ban the sale of the book, stating that it was a blast from hell. While Harding apparently made child support payments that were hand-delivered by the Secret Service for the daughter he never met until he died in 1923. A grandson told the New York Times that Britton was apparently in love with Harding until the day she died. An affidavit exists saying that Harding had an affair with his Senate staff secretary, so these are other women, and Harding may have fathered another daughter, Marion Louise Hodder, with one of his wife Florence's childhood friends. But DNA evidence hasn't confirmed that. Well, apparently he and his wife Florence weren't very close because Harding mentions in one letter that there isn't one iota of affection in my home relationship. It is merely existence necessary for appearance's sake, and Florence had a number of health problems, so that could explain that. Okay, so listeners, I didn't want to dwell too much on the raunchy details, but it's important to understand theories about the death of Warren G. Harding and if he could have been secretly assassinated because there were ulterior motives for a number of people. So first, let's look at the facts of Harding's death and then we'll look into the theories. The news of Harding's death was a shock to America, to his close friends, and to loved ones. He seemed robust and big and strong and healthy and outgoing and affable and full of energy. He was over 6 feet tall, he was handsome and friendly, and the common view of Warren Harding was that more than anything, he looked like a president. This was after presidents like Theodore Roosevelt, who was so larger than life that he seemed unrelatable, or William Howard Taft, who was morbidly obese, and Woodrow Wilson, who was cold and distant, who presented himself as a savior to the world, especially at the Treaty of Paris. Harding, in contrast, was the first to be elected in an election allowing the full participation of women, and he seemed a calming paternal influence on a nation, hence his phrase, his campaign slogan, a return to normalcy. But midway through his term in office, he was dead. There had been no apparent sign of the approach of death for this relatively young president. He was, at the age of 58, he continued to love to travel. He was one of the most traveled presidents thus far in history. And he was constantly meeting with people. He'd always stop in front of any crowd at the White House or train stop and shake hands and greet those whom he had asked for their vote. In one of his such trips to Alaska, it put a significant strain on him, and after he received a strange coded message from Washington, he collapsed. At a rest stop at San Francisco, more changes in Harding's health began to occur. He complained of being very tired, and then he collapsed again. The first reports were that he may have been poisoned, possibly from eating tainted crab meat. The next day, attending doctors called it pneumonia and proclaimed his condition as grave. He rallied for a day, but then he had a final relapse on August 2nd, 1923. This came as his wife was alone reading to him. He went into a violent convulsion, she said, and then was gone. At 7:20 p.m. on the evening of August 2nd, 1923, he died in the presidential suite of San Francisco's Palace Hotel. His wife Florence was reading the Saturday Evening Post to him. The article in question was about Mr. Harding and appeared to please him because he was last heard to utter, "That's good, go on." But immediately after this, he shuddered and dropped dead on his bed. Symptoms that he had before his death included illness with cramps, indigestion, a fever, and a shortness of breath. He chalked up his feelings so poorly to a week after succumbing to food poisoning and the stresses of his being on a 15,000-mile cross-country speaking tour, including the territory of Alaska, which was the first time that a U.S. president had visited that part of the nation. This was called the Voyage of Understanding, and it was a part of an early re-election campaign. Well, even though he appeared robust and healthy, Harding was never a very healthy man. He suffered from a nervous condition that was known as neurasthenia. Some of his doctors warned Harding, while he was still in the U.S. Senate, that his multiple affairs might physically injure his delicate and enlarged heart. Since at least 1918, Harding suffered from shortness of breath and bouts of chest pain and difficulty sleeping unless his head was propped up on several pillows. He also ate very poorly. He loved waffles and beef every single breakfast. Well, part of his health problems might have to do with the medical advice he received. Mr. and Mrs. Harding's favorite doctor was a homeopathic physician from Ohio named Charles Sawyer, had a similar type of medical background as Harding's father did. The president appointed him as Brigadier General in the U.S. Army and the chairman of the Federal Hospitalization Board. Harding's other physician was the much better trained Joel T. Boone, a U.S. Naval officer and Medal of Honor winner. Dr. Sawyer was given to dosing the president with purgatives, laxatives, and injections of heart stimulants, including arsenic, which didn't always sit well with Dr. Boone. The two had medical disagreements, but President Harding's doctors arranged for him to be examined when he was in San Francisco, including by Ray Lyman Wilbur, the president of Stanford University, also a president of the American Medical Association and a leading heart specialist. The nurses present on the scene instructed the Secret Service agent on duty to find Dr. Sawyer, who was down the hall, and Dr. Boone, who was out dining with General Pershing, the World War I general. The first official to reach the death scene of Harding was the Secretary of Commerce, Herbert Hoover. By the time the president's doctors arrived, around 7:30 p.m., he was already dead. Vice President Calvin Coolidge was sworn into office at 2:43 a.m. Eastern Time at his home in Plymouth, Vermont. Well, part of the reason we don't know much about Warren G. Harding's death, and there are so many theories about it, has to do with Mrs. Harding's refusal to allow the doctors to perform an autopsy and instead order that her husband be embalmed shortly after his death. Wilbur was frustrated by this refusal because the press and the public blamed the president's doctors for incompetence or malpractice or even plotting to poison the president. He said, "We were accused of being abysmally ignorant, stupid, and incompetent," Dr. Wilbur wrote in later years. On the evening of the president's death, Herbert Hoover sent out official news that the president had died of a stroke of cerebral apoplexy, but it was most likely a sudden heart attack that ended Harding's life at the age of 58 due to his heart condition, his poor diet, and his active work schedule. But we should remember that he lived 2 years longer than the average lifespan for an American male in 1923, which was 56, so it's not completely out of the question that he would have died at that age, and we don't have to automatically run to foul play. All right, so let's look on some of the theories out there on Harding's death now that we've gone beyond the facts of the matter. There are several possible explanations for Warren G. Harding's death. The death was interesting because there were five physicians present at his site of death in San Francisco. Like I said, one was president of the American Medical Association. There was also a cardiologist, and they all misdiagnosed the death as a stroke, which only takes 10 minutes. But a heart attack is instantaneous. If there had been an autopsy, then this might have stopped the confusion. But shortly after this, rumors began, although a number of them are baseless. First, there was the theory that it was his wife who killed him and was tired of his numerous sexual trysts. For example, he and his wife had some close friends in Ohio with whom they frequently vacationed. Harding had an affair with the woman, Carrie Phillips, and she constantly threatened to expose him until finally rumors had reached Mrs. Harding. Florence Harding knew of these affairs, and those who think that she killed her husband, she was increasingly losing her grip. Such scandals, as humiliating as they were to her, was more terrifying now that she was the first lady than they were when she was just the wife of the senator. She had always been sickly, and she would die within a year of the president's death, and soon suspicion rose of her role in San Francisco. A lot of this comes from a book written in 1930 by Gaston Means. He was a former Harding administrator official who was embittered at how he'd been locked out of power, and he published a book called The Strange Death of President Harding. In addition to his short stint with the Department of Justice's Bureau of Investigation, he was also a con man and a bootlegger who died in Leavenworth Prison in 1938 after being convicted for a con he tried to pull related to Charles Lindbergh Jr.'s kidnapping. He's not really a guy that sounds like we can trust very much. Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors.
They were some of the most powerful men who've ever lived. They waged war, forged peace, and altered the fates of billions of people. And yet, they were just as human, just as flawed as you and me. They were the presidents of the United States, and they are the subjects of the history podcast, This American President. In each episode of This American President, we explore how flawed men have managed this awesome responsibility. To listen now, go to ParthenonPodcast.com or search This American President on your favorite podcast platform.
After Teddy Roosevelt's failed third-party presidential run, he thought that he would reassemble the Rough Riders for a final charge against the Germans in World War I by launching a cavalry attack against 50-caliber machine guns. Here's an interview with Bill Hazelgrove to look at this incredible story.
Teddy Roosevelt was one of these people who seemed indestructible. And that's why I think a lot of Americans wanted him to go, because in a way, he was their Superman.
To listen to this full interview, check out the History Unplugged podcast on the podcast player of your choice.
So in the book, he claimed that Florence Harding poisoned her husband. He also gathered together tales about scandals within the Harding administration, including the Teapot Dome scandal, prohibition violations, as well as Harding's clandestine love affairs, one of which may or may not have led to the birth of an illegitimate child. Another rumor is that Warren G. Harding committed suicide by taking poison. And this idea gained currency through the publication of Samuel Hopkins Adams' book, Revelry. It was a novel largely based on the facts of the Harding administration. It's a fictionalized account of what happens, and that's part of the plot line. So both the suicide theory and the Means story, the Gaston Means story, were considered plausible. The poisoning came from eating crab meat on the presidential boat on the return from Alaska, but the list of supplies in the steward's pantry contained no crab meat, and no one else in the presidential party was ill. Furthermore, the fatal stroke of apoplexy, the official medical explanation for why he died, occurred when the president was recovering from pneumonia. Mrs. Harding was apparently alone with him at the time, and the verdict of the physicians, not being based on an autopsy, was really only an expression of opinion and not any medical fact. All right, so now let's look at the original question that was asked by Eric Gold about Harry Daugherty's involvement. Harry Daugherty was the attorney general, and he was disliked because he had been an Ohio political fixer. He was a lawyer, he had a law practice for a while, and then he followed Harding around. He was Harding's campaign manager, and a very able one, of course. He predicted Harding's nomination in a smoke-filled room about 1 or 2 in the morning at the Chicago Convention of 1920. Harding was a natural candidate, the candidate that everyone could agree on after the two main contenders fought each other to exhaustion. Daugherty served for a few months in the Coolidge administration, but his behavior, his erratic behavior, made it difficult for Coolidge to put up with it. At one time, he went over to the White House, and in effect, he told President Coolidge off, and that's what eventually led to his firing. When Harry Daugherty was called upon Judge Thatcher for information for the federal grand jury in New York in 1926 about the death of Harding, here's what he said. Having been personal attorney for Warren G. Harding before he was senator from Ohio, and while he was senator, and thereafter until his death, and for Mrs. Harding for a period of several years and before her husband was elected president and after his death, and having been attorney for the Midland National Bank of Washington Courthouse and for my brother, M.S. Daugherty, and having been attorney general of the United States during the time that President Harding served as president, and also for a time after President Harding's death under President Coolidge, and with all those named as attorney, personal friend, and attorney general, my relations were of the most confidential character as well as professional. I refused to testify and answer questions put to me because the answer I might give or make and the testimony I might give might tend to incriminate me. So he pleads the fifth about Harding, although he's probably just trying to cover himself due to the different types of political scandals he was involved in. And just to give some more context about the role that Daugherty played in Harding's circle, after he achieved power, Harding gathered around him a group of political cronies, including factional friends from the Ohio Republican establishment, like Daugherty and others of like mind from the states, a group known as the Ohio Gang, although this name was given later by political opponents of Harding. Critics, such as Harding's Secretary of Commerce Herbert Hoover, viewed the clique with disgust. Hoover noted the following about Harding. He enjoyed the company of these men and his old Ohio associates in and out of his government. Weekly White House poker parties were his greatest relaxation. The stakes were not large, but the play lasted most of the night. I lived too long on the frontiers of the world to have strong emotions against people playing poker for money, if they liked it, but it irked me to see it in the White House. Several of Harding's Ohio Gang associates lost no time enriching themselves at the public expense. Soon, rumblings began to be heard over possible malfeasance in various government departments, including Daugherty's Department of Justice. So Herbert Hoover always suspected Daugherty, and this is part of the reason that Daugherty has thought that he might be involved in some foul play with Harding's death. On April 14, 1922, the Wall Street Journal broke a sensational story about a bribery scheme involving oil company kickbacks to government officials in exchange for granting extraordinarily favorable oil extraction leases with single bid contracts. The next day, Democratic Senator John Kendrick of Wyoming introduced a resolution which set in motion the Senate investigation that ultimately exposed the so-called Teapot Dome scandal involving an illegal financial relationship between Fall, Harding's Secretary of the Interior, and a subsidiary of the Sinclair Consolidated Oil Corporation. Opponents accused Daugherty of the administration of having been complicit in the Teapot Dome affair by failing to intervene after he had learned of the malfeasance. After giving his testimony in the matter, Daugherty was cleared of wrongdoing, and the final report indicated the Attorney General had neither been aware of the fraudulent oil contracts, nor had he taken any bribes. The specific absolution didn't mean that he was on the level, though. And in 1923, as Harding was preparing to leave on a working cruise to Alaska, Daugherty's personal assistant, Jess Smith, suddenly committed suicide. Even though he was a pious Quaker, Hoover was never part of the president's inner circle, but he was abruptly added to the traveling party on the cruise by a nervous and distraught Harding, who apparently sought his counsel. So Harding's death didn't do anything to stop the eruption of scandals around his administration and revolving around his Ohio clique, and the news was dominated by stories of the Teapot Dome bribery and allegations of wrongdoing in the Office of Alien Property Custodian, the Veterans Bureau, and the Office of the Attorney General. When new President Calvin Coolidge resisted calls to sack Daugherty and fire him, Hoover and Secretary of State Charles Evans prevailed upon him to eliminate him. They considered he was corrupt. So on March 28, 1924, Coolidge acquiesced and demanded and received a letter of resignation from Daugherty. So definitely by far, Daugherty was tainted with scandal. He was involved in all these things. But all of the theories about assassination of Warren G. Harding, I don't think that they have good merit because they're based on secondhand and third-hand allegations of people writing books years after the fact who have no firsthand proof whatsoever. They're basically making allegations. Daugherty, him trying to assassinate Harding to cover himself, that's much like his wife trying to assassinate him. That's only based on the speculation of books written much later, like The Strange Death of Warren G. Harding. So that's why, Eric Gold, I don't think that he was involved, and I think he just died of natural causes. Now, to close out this episode, let's look into some of the other theories about Warren G. Harding, and I mentioned earlier that some thought that he was, interestingly enough, America's first black president. Where does this idea come from? Essentially, what happened is that one man called Warren G. Harding a Negro and produced a broadsheet and a book to slander him. Where he got this idea is that Harding's family was connected to the Underground Railroad. His uncle was a conductor there, but all evidence, whether it comes from presidential biographers or the Warren G. Harding Presidential Library, say that Warren G. Harding's genealogy is set back to Europe, and we don't see any black ancestry there. Well, where this claim comes from is consider the context of the 1920s, when racism continues to be intense. Publications were beginning to appear attesting to a rumor that Harding's genealogy showed an African-American connection. It comes from Professor William Chancellor of Worcester University, who wrote a book called The Right of the American People to Know, tracing the genealogy of the president, and he said that Harding was part African-American. In the 1920s, such claims, whether they were true or not, could be somebody's political death, especially if they were in the South. But even in the North, this wouldn't help anyone out. Agents of the Secret Service and Bureau of Investigation quickly confiscated the printing and plates of the book, but a few slipped through, and this led into the rumor that's gone on for a very long time in America about the president's ancestry. There's two elements about whether or not Harding was black. Harding is at the top of the list of presidents who have been categorized as black. This line of thought goes back to the obsession that many in the 19th and 20th centuries had with bloodlines. During a time when the so-called one-drop rule was used to define race, segregationists and social Darwinists found it important to be able to define race and argued that a person with any black ancestry was in fact black. And this is the 1920s, and during this time period, racial eugenics was very popular. Harding even mentioned it in his acceptance speech at the Republican National Committee. The issue of race was injected in the 1920 presidential campaign as part of an effort to sink Harding. Chancellor attempted to destroy Harding's candidacy by charging that he said he was a hybrid, an octoroon, which means somebody who's one-eighth black, descended from Negro ancestors. Chancellor was a devoted scientific racist. He was also a Democrat who had strongly supported President Woodrow Wilson, and he argued that Harding's supposed mixed racial ancestry disqualified him from the presidency. So what did Chancellor offer as evidence? Well, all he did was he found people in central and northern Ohio who were willing to testify that members of Harding's family were black. They offered a variety of stories, many of which contradicted each other, and there was no hard evidence. Chancellor and many of those he interviewed dealt in the worst possible stereotypes of black promiscuity or descriptions of physical appearance, as if parts of Warren G. Harding's physical appearance prove that he had this or that ancestry. Well, as president, Harding spoke out against the Klan, and he gave that speech I mentioned earlier in Birmingham, that was very thoughtful for a man of the time. He called for qualified blacks to be able to vote. They probably would have voted Republican anyway if they could have, but overall, he really didn't accomplish that much for America's African-American population, although you can argue that it was members of his own party or Democrats in the South who stymied all of these efforts. Well, Chancellor failed in his effort to prevent Harding's election, but he did succeed in making the story about Harding's supposed racial ancestry an enduring part of his legacy. This became relevant during the 1960s when a book was written that was in reaction to the civil rights movement. It was called The Shadow of Blooming Grove. It's a biography of Harding by Francis Russell, and he drew on Chancellor's work to make the possibility of African-American ancestry. He called it the dark shadow that haunted Harding and his professional and political life. Another book that came out about the time saw Harding's so-called ancestry as a positive thing. J.A. Rogers wrote a book called The Five Negro Presidents that claimed that other presidents had a black ancestry. And it raised the idea embraced by some African-Americans at the time that several presidents had black ancestry. Rogers' book, it's very brief, it's considered a critique of racial politics or a proclamation of racial pride, but it relies on the same sources that other books relied on. The most recent example of a black person claiming Harding as a black president is Marcia Stewart's Warren Harding, U.S. President 29, Death by Blackness, which came out in 2005. She claimed to be a distant relation of the president, and the evidence of her claim is taken from Russell and Chancellor and family lore, so there's not hard evidence there. So I guess that's a message of racial progress in the United States. In the 1920s, that would be considered a slander to call someone a black president. But now people are trying to claim Warren G. Harding as one of their own. So take that as you will of progress, I suppose. One last thing I'm going to do in this episode is explore the question of whether Warren G. Harding deserves some member of rehabilitation. Is his reputation as the worst president in American history deserved, or does he belong on the pantheon of mid-tier to lower mid-tier presidents? Well, I'm not going to offer the definitive answer here because I'm not a presidential historian, but I will offer an opinion of maybe the most pro-Harding historian you can find, Robert Farrell. He wrote a book called The Strange Deaths. Plural deaths of President Warren G. Harding. The deaths there are not only his real death, but the death of his reputation. And if you want to explore pro-Harding arguments, this is the book to go to. And let me conclude with this. He said that Warren G. Harding was a 20th century president whose measurement by fellow historians and by political scientists he think has been almost completely wrong. The measurements of the president in the 20th and 21st centuries he thinks are completely misguided. Arthur Schlesinger, in his book, remarked how Eisenhower came up from the 23rd among presidents in polls among historians to now the upper level of the average president. He said Eisenhower has risen quite high in the level of historians. This is because Eisenhower's papers were open in the 1980s, and they were remarkable. Among other things, Eisenhower's diaries were published. So historians realize that Eisenhower, behind the scenes, was a much better president than his public image would suggests, that he was a bland, vanilla person who was hands-off in affairs. But behind the scenes, he really was proactive in making the United States run as efficiently as possible. Now, I should note that Robert Farrell made that statement in the 1990s. This was before Warren G. Harding's love letters to his mistress were revealed, and that did nothing to help his cause. But the point being that opinions of a president can change over time. They can be reassessed. So nothing is impossible. Perhaps the reputation of America's worst president can be salvaged.
Well, that's all for today's episode. Thanks for sticking with me all the way to the end. First off, I'd like to thank History Unplugged's Spy Masters, which you can easily become, and I'll explain what that is after listing them off. They are, in no particular order, Baron Fraser, Chris C., David Santee, Josh from VFW Post 2285, Jake Harrington, Josh Reddick, Jeff Mitchell, owner of Mountain West Commercial Las Vegas, Michael from New York, Michael Piccinetti, Nick Brooks, Rob from Chicago, Salvador Sanchez, Tom from Ohio, Moondoggy from Ohio, Bill Ivey, Bruce Ashby from Wire Meets Wood Guitars, WMWGuitars.com, Los, Sergeant Hooch, Sumo41, and Willie from New Jersey. Now, having thanked my Spymasters, I'd like to mention some ways you can get more involved with what I'm doing with History Unplugged. First, if you want to comment on the most recent episodes, you can check out the History Unplugged Facebook or YouTube page, which are video recordings of all the episodes, and they often come out before the audio episodes do. Second, please like and subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice. This helps the show grow and find new listeners. Finally, the best way you can get involved is to join History Unplugged's membership program called the Knowlton's Rangers. This is the place where you can directly partner with me when it comes to the creation of the sorts of episodes I do, or I can most directly talk with you, the listener. I call it the Knowlton's Rangers because they were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War. Go to patreon.com/unplugged and you can join at three levels. Join at the Scout level, you'll get early access to all new episodes and completely ad-free episodes, and I have about 500 by now. Join at the Intelligence Officer level, you get all the same stuff as level one, and you also get premium episodes. I'm doing a series on the life of Audie Murphy, on Americans who fought in World War I for the French Foreign Legion, and another series on Teddy Roosevelt's adventures in the Dakota Badlands. I have about 50 or so of these episodes now. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you get all the things from the first two tiers. You get a shout out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get three hardcover books, and you can ask me a question on absolutely anything in history, and I will devote an entire episode to answering it. So check out all those bonuses by going to patreon.com/unplugged. Wonderful listeners, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and see you next time.